The comfort of your favorite seat is now your comfy car selling command center, thanks to Carvana.
It doesn't get any better than this.
Your favorite seat's the best spot in the house. Make it even better by entering your license plate or VIN and getting a real offer in minutes.
There really is no place like home.
And speaking of home, Carvana will pick up your car from yours after you finalize your offer. Visit Carvana.com or download the app and sell your car from your comfy place.
Welcome to the Seneca Podcast, a weekly discussion of current affairs in China, coming to you from a cozy Airbnb in Brooklyn Heights, NYC. Happy Chinese New Year to everybody. I am Kaiser Guo, immoderately thrilled to be joined here this week by none other than Jeremy Goldkorn, the man behind Danway.com. How are you, Jeremy?
I'm doing very well indeed, Kaiser. It's a real pleasure to see you in New York City.
Yeah, great to be able to be here podcasting. This, by the way, made possible by our good friend and previous guest on Seneca, Eric Fish from the Asia Society, who graciously lent us his recording gear for this session.
So Jeremy, listen to his podcast.
Yeah, listen to his podcast, absolutely, from the Asia Society. It's really great. You enjoying your time here in New York?
It's always fantastic to be in New York. What a city.
Yeah. I have been having a splendid time. I got a chance to finally see my brother's Broadway musical, Allegiance.
Starring... Yeah, can you tell us about it?
Yeah,
I haven't had a chance to see it yet.
Well, I hope you should. Yeah. You should definitely. It stars George Takei of Star Trek fame, he basically owns the internet now, I believe. And Lea Salonga, who was a Tony Award-winning singer, who was actually, she won for Miss Saigon, a Tony, but she was also the voice of Princess Jasmine in the Disney film Aladdin. It's absolutely terrific. It actually exceeded my already kind of unreasonably high expectations of it, but of course, you know, it was my brother who wrote the music and the lyrics. So Jay, man, that was just great. It was great getting to sit next to him during the show and to actually meet the cast afterward. It's about life in the Japanese internment camps during the Second World War. Not exactly what one thinks of as fair for cheery Broadway musical theater, but it was actually done in a serious and yet very kind of joyous and fun way. It's great. I mean, absolutely see it. But of course, the episode, the things that it talks about are one of the more shameful episodes in American history. I mean, 120,000 Americans of Japanese ancestry were, or Japanese themselves, were interned after Pearl Harbor. And the show is actually based on George Takei's personal experience in childhood. He was in the camps as a child. Perhaps, you know, this is going to be remembered as the worst case of racial profiling by the U.S. federal government. Unless, of course, Donald Trump actually gets elected, in which case, you know, all bets are off. So we're going to be talking today, among other things, about racial profiling today, this time as directed against Chinese Americans and Chinese nationals in the U.S. So here with us in our impromptu studio here to talk about this is Holly Chang, who is acting executive director of the Committee of 100 and one of my absolute favorite human beings on this planet, someone who I think very much shares my own personal mission in kind of enhancing mutual understanding between the U.S. and China. So Holly grew up in Kentucky and in Texas and was trained as a civil engineer, but instead of actually building physical bridges, she has devoted her abundant talents to building the other kind of bridges, that is, bridges of understanding between the U.S. and China. Holly is the founder of Project Pengyou, which I've recommended before on this show and which I've been involved with from very early on, and she's a creature of incomparable goodness and selfless dedication. So it was to this, she's all verklempt now, to our great city, Beijing's eternal...
You really know how to lay on the schmaltz, guys. Yeah, I mean, well, Holly is wonderful, but...
I mean it entirely sincerely. I really do. To the great loss of our fair city of Beijing, where she lived for 10 years. She moved recently back to the States and to New York here, where she's now, as I said, the acting director of the Committee of 100, executive director of the Committee of 100, which is, of course, a shadowy and secretive organization that, well, I'm kidding, of course. So she'll tell us what it is. But first, in a long overdue turn on Seneca, welcome Holly Chang. How are you?
Thank you, Kaiser, for that very overly generous introduction, and I must say that this I've been following Seneca for a long time, and it I always listen to it when I want to feel smarter and learn things that are smarter. So I'm very honored to be invited to come speak about something, some of the things that I'm working on. So thank you.
You missing Beijing yet?
I am. I wasn't ready to leave, and I'm ready to see what's next for Beijing, but I really miss it.
I mean, I saw you back there not too long ago, and you're coming back pretty frequently still, yeah?
I still go back quite frequently, probably 6 times last year or so.
Wow. That's good. I mean, I hope I'm going to be able to do that after I relocate here. But so let's maybe jump in and talk about some of the work you've done with First Project Pengyou, which is a great organization. So what's Project Pengyou all about? What's its mission, and what are you guys doing these days?
Right. Well, Project Pengyou is a network of young Americans who have lived and studied in China. So it actually began as the alumni network of President Obama's 100,000 Strong Initiative, and they had worked with the State Department to bring this program to fruition. And the State Department approached us a while back and asked if we were willing to build this community of Americans who had lived and studied in China.
And can I just, let's clarify for people who might not be aware, the Obama's 100,000 Strong program, what is that?
Well, that was an announcement that he made when he first came to Shanghai to try to send 100,000 young Americans to study in China over 4 years.
That was back in September 2009, right?
That was in September 2009. But I think the initiative itself, although it was announced in Shanghai, it was probably it probably started around 2010, 2011, when Hillary Clinton started kind of taking it over under her leadership.
Right. And they actually, I mean, I've been, you know, in close touch with them, with Carol McGifford, and mm-hmm. they reached that 100,000 goal, and they're now actually shooting for 1 million, right? I mean, it's the million strong is the new incarnation.
Right, right. Yeah, well, I think most recently there was the announcement from Obama during Xi Jinping's visit that they wanted to reach 1 million Americans learning Mandarin.
Wow.
So I think it's a great goal.
Yeah, it's a terrific goal. It's an organization I can really get behind.
Yeah.
So Project Pengyou started, it was sort of an alumni network. I mean, because
right.
What part of the problem is that once you've left China,
right.
You're back here in the States and you
right. So what we do when they come back is we provide some leadership training. So we recruit Americans who have come back and we provide leadership training, which is actually based off a course that's taught at Harvard called Leading Change. Mm-hmm. And it teaches community organizing, how do you build a community towards a shared purpose. And what we found out was that a lot of young Americans that came back and especially the ones that went to underrepresented areas or went back to underrepresented areas like Tennessee and Kentucky and Indiana and the South and the Midwest, where it's so important. There's increasing foreign direct investment from China into these non-Washingtonian states, but at the same time, there aren't a lot of I would say human resources and in this supportive environment for young Americans who care about the China relationship to grow in this knowledge space and in this workspace.
Jeremy, y'all have a chapter down there in Tennessee, right?
I believe we do.
are we going to count
we'll
on you to get more
you.
Involved now with that? And
things are starting to happen, in the South, in Tennessee. I mean, I'm on the board of the Tennessee China Network, which was founded by Elizabeth Rowland, who's also a former Beijing resident.
Yeah.
Yes.
So it's growing.
We know her.
We know her. We love her.
She's great.
Hi, Elizabeth.
So we're building. We actually empower young people to go back to their schools and build chapters in throughout the United States. We have about 30 plus chapters that we've built in the last year or so, or established in the last year or so, and they work on activities and elevate the voices that are more constructive and unifying, empowering, empathetic towards China or towards the U.S. and China, and also trying to bring Chinese and Americans together in to have a new kind of dialogue and elevate that.
And the original, the idea of Project, I mean, one of the things that I thought was really compelling when you first explained this to me was the power of getting people to work together on projects and how that is just such a bonding
Absolutely.
Experience. Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah. Exactly. It's not just talking about things, but actually bringing them together. So it's Chinese New Year this weekend. And on Monday, it'll be officially Chinese New Year. And one of the things that the chapters will be doing is going to schools throughout the country that especially younger or underrepresented or inner city schools to talk about their China experiences and to kind of pay it forward and inspire next gen, even younger people in America to learn more about China and Chinese culture. So, those are some of the things that through this network, you know, we can send out this, we help them work together, even though they might be only a few people in Tennessee, you know, they can kind of mobilize and also connect to a larger network so that they're more motivated.
And where do people find you? If people are listening out there and they want to get involved, where do we find you?
Oh, we'll go online to projectpengyou.org and sign up, and you'll hear more about our upcoming leadership training and reunions and events. We should have an event coming up in Beijing pretty soon around the next visit of the Secretary of State, but that's still in the works.
Wonderful, wonderful. You know, be sure to tell us about that so that we can publicize it here on Seneca. And also, tell us a little bit about the Committee of 100. I think, you know, not too many people know about it. And, you know, the name sounds a little, you know, ominous and Illuminati.
Well, I would have to start by saying that I'm the acting executive director, so I'm not an official spokesperson for the committee. But I can talk about my own opinion about the committee and talk about some of the projects that I'm working on there. I think it's a really amazing and wonderful organization. It's a membership organization of Chinese Americans that work on a dual mission to promote the full participation and the full inclusion of Chinese Americans in the United States, as well as advance U.S.-China relations, kind of leveraging the membership.
There were some pretty high-profile Chinese Americans who started this organization, right?
That's right. It was founded by Ian Pei, Yo-Yo Ma, cellist Yo-Yo Ma, financier Henry Tang, Oscar Tang, mm-hmm. Businesswoman Shirley Young, a Nobel physicist or Nobel-level physicist. She actually couldn't get the Nobel Prize, but her protégés received the Nobel on her behalf, okay, so to speak. But very prominent Chinese Americans. And at that time, when they launched the Committee of 100, there were first 40 members that they brought together in the aftermath of the Tiananmen Square incident. And that was probably at the peak of maybe the worst times between U.S. and China. I mean, we're kind of going through a cool war, so to speak. But at mm-hmm. that time in recent history, that was probably some of the worst times between in the relationship.
Certainly, for
good reason. But I think there was talk in Washington and elsewhere that we should really cut off normalized relations. At that time, normalized relations were only about 10 years old.
Right.
And if there is a community that will be affected and feels very personal about that relationship, it's the Chinese Americans. And they felt very strongly that America should continue its relationship with China. So one of the first things they did was form this group. Out of the 40 that were formed, I believe about half are still active in the organization, which is amazing after 25, 26 years. And I think that it's one of the rare organizations that works at a very high level with both the Chinese government as well as the U.S. government, and also works on cross straits. You know, they also visit Taiwan, and we have a lot of Taiwanese American members as well. Mm-hmm. So it's one of the few organizations that might play an interesting role in
cross straits relations.
Cross straits, right. Potentially, yeah.
Yeah. If some of our older listeners or more faithful, longtime listeners may remember that we actually had Angie Tang, who was formerly, I guess, in your position, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, she was
mm-hmm.
former executive director who came in to talk about a perception study
We do that study. We did the last study about 4 years ago.
Oh, great.
And we're getting ready to do that again.
4 years ago, wow. It seems like yes.
When will the new one come out? I'd be very interested, given the events of the last couple of years.
Absolutely, and we'll probably add a lot more questions related to some of the more recent events,
I don't think we've explained fully the perceptions of
Chinese toward Americans,
Chinese towards Americans,
and Americans towards
and
Chinese.
Americans towards Chinese. So it's looking at both sides of the pond, of the Pacific pond.
Right. Well, the Committee of 100 has been doing opinion surveys of the American public since 1994. So over 20 years, we're probably the only organization that has been doing China or Chinese-related opinion surveys publicly. And more recently, I guess in 2007, they began doing mirror surveys, meaning that they started working with a Chinese group to survey Chinese attitudes towards America. And then, of course, now there are many studies out there, including the Pew Global Attitude Survey. Yeah. That will be coming out probably in May. And we'll probably have something around the same time. We have an annual conference that's coming up. The Committee of 100 has an annual conference that's coming up in Los Angeles in April 15th, 16th, and 17th. And at that time, we'll probably reveal some of the results of the next survey.
Cool, and we're sure to talk about that on Seneca, and hopefully we'll be able to drag you in again.
It should be an interesting time to do that survey, I believe.
Mm-hmm. One of the let's talk about some of the work that you guys are doing currently.
Sure.
I mean, as I hinted at earlier in the intro, one of the things that you've taken on recently is the problem of racial profiling of Chinese and Chinese American scientists working mm-hmm. in the United States.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, this has been a problem, of course, since the very, very famous case of Wen Ho Li, who was, if I remember correctly, he was a Los Alamos physicist. Mm-hmm. He was born in Taiwan. In late 99, he was actually indicted on, mm-hmm. I think it was like 59 counts.
Right.
And as it turned out, I mean, he ended up pleading to one count of mishandling of classified
basically information. Taking some documents home in his briefcase.
Right. I mean, he was essentially just innocent of anything like that. But his life was upended, and I mean, he got really just fucked by this whole thing. Right?
Yeah. Well, I think that there's a lot of politics involved when it's that high profile. So many news outlets have gotten involved, and so it would have been very difficult. Given that he was in solitary confinement, how badly they treated him, they weren't going to let him go completely free. And in fact, when he did end up pleading guilty, the judge publicly and formally apologized to him, which I think is a very significant event that he apologized on behalf of the government and how the government treated him.
And I think he got a pretty substantial compensation too, including from media outlets who had leaked his name before
he was indicted. That's right. So he received like $1.6 million or something like that for everything, for his 1 year in solitary confinement and for all of his legal charges. But actually, most of all of that went to pay for legal charges. I don't think people understand how expensive the legal system is in America. To have to fight a case like that.
Right. I mean, when it's an espionage case like this, especially, God. And so has there been a surge in recent years of cases like this? I mean, I've been seeing more and more articles about this.
Yeah, it's interesting. Just in the last 18 months or so, it seems like there have been at least four people that have been very, very publicly indicted. They're all Chinese American. They're all naturalized Chinese American. So they're all, born in China and naturalized as American citizens, and indicted for extremely heavy charges of espionage, being accused of being a spy, being accused of treasonous behavior, being held at gunpoint, arrested. And then the charges are completely
arrested in front
dropped.
Of their children, right? I mean,
right. Yeah. Well, the most recent case with Dr. Xi, Xiaoxing Xi from Temple University. Mm-hmm, he was a physicist, a very, very renowned physics professor there. And he was arrested at gunpoint in front of his kids and his family.
Good Lord.
Yeah. And then
what was he working on, may I ask? What kind of technology?
I believe they thought that he was, well, first of all, they charged him on something that was completely unrelated to espionage. It seems unrelated. So one of the scary things is that you can really get charged for anything. But I think he was charged for wire fraud, that there was some money that might have been exchanged or something like that. And it was supposedly a trade secret that he was selling.
A commercial secret, not a military secret, a commercial secret.
But somehow it had elevated to the point where, if it's a commercial secret, you would think white collar crime. They kind of alert you and let you know that your accounts are frozen and things like that. They don't come to your home with a SWAT team and guns. So I'm not quite sure, you know, how you know, going back to what you were saying about the racial profiling, it's a little bit scary being a Chinese American to think that somebody that has succeeded their entire life, been done the right thing, has crossed all their T's, dotted all their I's, and did everything, was a scientist, you know, do your family proud and become a dean of a school, and then for all of this to happen. I mean, I don't know the exact amount of legal charges that he faces, despite the fact that 6 months later, all charges were dropped.
All charges were dropped.
Yeah, all charges were dropped because in the end, the technology was, they got it wrong. I mean, they didn't do their homework. The feds didn't do the homework. And they had thought it was selling technology, right, of some pocket heater.
Pocket
exactly.
Heater, right.
And then during the his defense, or well, his defense actually found the person that created the pocket heater to go and testify and say, that's not the pocket heater. And so, you know, after that, they had a few people give testimonies, including some members at the Committee of 100, and they finally dropped all charges. But at this point, he's, I mean, you know, a few $100,000 in legal debt. So,
and Holly, can I ask, is it clear that this is, you know, targeting Chinese? I mean, is this not just the overreach of the surveillance state, and that, say, Muslim scientists are under equal scrutiny?
Right.
I mean, obviously, the Muslim Americans are under scrutiny for other things, for terrorism.
Right,
but
right,
in terms of this particular thing, industrial or military,
right,
espionage.
Well,
is there,
you know, I think that that's a fair statement. I mean, and a fair question. I believe, you know, in terms of the cases, we've been trying to look at the cases, and again, I can't speak officially. I do know that Iran and China are the two cases that tend to be to be brought, or those are the two countries that tend to be brought up in economic and espionage cases. And I think out of the ones that China is relevant, probably around 80% of those that are accused are Chinese.
Wow.
I mean, just you know, looking at some of the numbers. So I don't know if that's profiling or if that increases. If these are, again, some of these cases are extremely severe and threaten our national security. But at the same time, you have 1 million Chinese Americans that are working in STEM fields and building up innovative technologies. And because of their work in America, you know, in all of their work in Silicon Valley and elsewhere, that that you can't say that all 1 million of them that are working in America are actually spies. And that's what's happening, is that when you very publicly, I mean, these are press releases sent from Department of Justice that say so-and-so has been indicted and we found one of those spies, and the case hasn't been you know, they haven't completely prosecuted.
Right.
That I think that the very public nature of this creates a hazard of racial profiling. Not necessarily saying that there's an institutionalized, you know, rule that they're going to racially profile, but I think that there is this tendency to know that generally, oh, this is happening, and if they're going to be very public about it, and all of the fear that is mongered, so to speak, from politicians and on Capitol Hill, I think it does create a tendency of looking suspiciously at a Chinese in your office,
and Chinese aren't just vulnerable in that sense. I mean, vulnerable to the accusations, but they're also vulnerable to approaches by Chinese intelligence.
Absolutely.
So let's talk a little bit about that.
yeah.
I mean, if you're able, I don't. I mean,
sure.
Because, you know, that is something that happens. I mean, we're
right,
we're certainly aware. You know.
Yeah.
That,
I do think that I think that, first of all, I think that Chinese Americans are a very unique community in the U.S.-China space. Specifically, I lived in China for 10 years, and there are things that I believe I was able to do within the civil society sector in the nonprofit world that I don't publicize very openly like I do with Project Pengyou, but I've been working on other projects in the philanthropic sector. And I believe that if I didn't look Chinese, and if I didn't have a sense of kinship, you know, and I could blend in, so to speak, with the rest of the people that I was working with, then I probably would not have been able to accomplish nearly as much as I did. And I also understood that I couldn't, you know, this issue of face and all of that I was willing to blend in to make sure that projects would get done. So I think that that was a double-edged sword.
Very much, yeah.
For Chinese, that on the one hand, we have this natural way of having kinship for both sides. So I also grew up American. I pledged allegiance to the flag growing up. And coming back, I understand the narrative in a different way than a pure Chinese that were to come from China.
Right,
obviously have a different kinship to this country and so I think that because of that, because of this ease in both cultures, we are in some ways targeted by both countries as targeted here for being a spy, targeted there to become a spy.
And indeed, there are spies. I mean, I think just last week there was the news of the guy who was crawling around in an Iowa cornfield trying to steal Monsanto and DuPont,
it was DuPont stuff.
GMO seeds, corn GMA. Seeds.
Right, which is a national security threat.
Right.
Right.
Well, yeah.
Well, no, I mean, I don't know. They somehow think it is. But I mean, do you remember that piece, Corn Wars?
Yeah. I
think
I remember reading it.
Yeah, that was, I think we recommended it on the site, on the podcast before.
So can I ask then? I mean, clearly, if you're an ethnically Chinese scientist, you are working on a project that is either sensitive because of military reasons or commercial reasons. You probably are at risk of coming under scrutiny. So
right.
I mean, what would you say people in this position should do to prepare or protect themselves?
Right. I think that's a really good question. One of the things that that the Committee of 100 does, and it's as an educational project, is to go out and give seminars. So we have extremely experienced legal experts that are Committee of 100 members. Brian Sun is one of them. We have legal scholars like Frank Wu. Nelson Dong is also a legal expert in this area. And they volunteer their time to give seminars to Chinese American scientists and engineers on the legal risk that they face in advancing technology between the U.S. and China. I mean, again, as I mentioned, there's like a million people in the STEM fields, a million Chinese Americans working in STEM fields. And because of that, all of them, if they're working at the cutting edge of any field, they're going to be in touch with sensitive, highly valuable information, whether it's valuable to their employer or valuable to this country. And that's just the nature of the work.
Yeah, they need to not be cavalier about it, you know, to take it home in their briefcase when they're...
Right, yeah, they need to be extra careful and not understand what their HR codes are at the company level, non-disclosure agreements and things like that, and know what they can't take home, know what a trade secret is that they can't take home and they can't be flippant about. I mean, you know, with Sherry Chen and Xiaoxing Xi, in both cases, if they had slipped up and done something. And in fact, with Sherry Chen,
let's talk about Sherry Chen's case. We haven't gotten into that yet.
That's true.
Right.
Yeah, so Sherry Chen is this hydrologist who forecasts flood threats for the federal government. And she was arrested in October 2014. And then 6 months later, they also dropped all charges. And Sherry, I believe, had family that was still in Beijing, and
her mom
was
sick or something, right?
I think it was her father.
Oh, her father. Okay.
And it's just so heartbreaking to hear her story because she's been working with the federal government for I want to say 25 years. So is this loyal, you know, federal servant, but she makes these frequent trips to China because her father is sick, and she's trying to be a filial daughter,
right.
And I believe she made one of the last trips and came back, and then she got arrested publicly at work, and she was accused of and in fact, when she was arrested, I believe that they had first questioned her, so she had worked for a number of hours, and then some agents came in and they asked if they could speak with her, and then they questioned her for 7 hours with no food, no water. And I think at some point, maybe like 3 or 4 hours in, she suddenly asked, "Do I need an attorney?" And I think they were like, no, it's fine. We're just asking questions. So I think it's really important, actually, for Chinese American scientists to know what their rights are. I mean, basically, you have the right to remain silent.
That's part of what your legal experts are doing in these seminars.
Exactly. Our legal experts talk about what their rights are, They also go over historic cases that show this pattern or apparent pattern. And they kind of pinpoint some of the details of ways that people are caught. And oftentimes they'll get indicted for something, for some high treasonous, reason. And then later on, they'll get charged with something like mishandling of sensitive information, mm-hmm. or something like that.
What happens to these people's lives afterward, though? I mean, is anyone ever able to recover from something like this? This is just, an enormous stigma. Even if you are found innocent, your life has been completely upended, right? I mean,
it's difficult to say. I think that for instance, Sherry Chen, I think she's still going through the after effects of what happened, and everything was in her life. It was very quiet and very normal until this happened and it upended. And now she doesn't have money to pay for legal fees. So she's trying to reach out into the community to gain support. I believe that she hasn't been given her job back, even though all charges have been dropped. And she is, she's 59, 60 years old. If you mirror what happened 20 plus years ago with Wen Ho Lee, after that, after his arrest, despite being a huge, purist of an engineer, so he mm-hmm. went on to write extremely deep engineering books, but he never got a job after that. He was 59 years old, never got a job.
He did write a memoir about his life, right?
I think he worked with somebody to write a memoir mm-hmm. about that, and I haven't read that memoir myself, but he's still alive and still around. But it's just amazing that this is coming back. And I know that there a lot of the founders of the Committee of 100, when they founded this organization, it concerns them that what's coming back, because it feels a little bit like the remnants of the McCarthyism and the hysteria that was raised because of the Cold War and the hysteria towards communism. Now and at that time it was racial as well. I mean, you had started by talking about allegiance and the Japanese internment. I mean, that was racial as well. I mean, we didn't intern, the Germans or anybody else. We interned the Japanese because they looked very different. They were identifiably different. That's right.
Can I ask actually both of you, including, Kaiser, you too, but aside from scientists working on, sensitive information, McCarthyism was sort of an interesting comparison because it went after communists and a lot of whom happened to be Jewish.
Right. That's right.
And
right.
It kind of, it had a bit of an anti-Semitic tint to it.
Right. The Rosenbergs.
How much do you feel that regular Chinese Americans or perhaps even just East Asians in America are affected by this? If you're just doing some job that isn't sensitive, do you think, and particularly given the current tense state of relations between China and the US, do you think you Chinese people in America are feeling the results of this in any other way?
I think that the Chinese American scientist community specifically is very concerned, and they don't really know what to do because on the one hand, most of their money for their work, for their innovation comes from the federal government. And so it's difficult for them to speak out. It's difficult for them to, how can you come speak out and not sound like you're trying to be
an apologist for it, right?
Right. An apologist or anti-government. I mean, it's difficult because I think that our loyalties are always questioned because of what we look like, what our race is, what our ethnicity is, what our heritage is.
And also because it's so difficult to tweeze apart sometimes. You try to inhabit two cultures simultaneously. Does that mean we try to inhabit two political allegiances simultaneously? No,
that's right.
But it doesn't. But
that's right.
It's hard for people
to quite
understand
that. I mean, at the
end of
the day, instance, I'm an American citizen. And so the allegiance that I pledge on a national level will have to is American. And because that's who holds my passport, that's who protects my rights. But in America, and I'm still dealing with this because I feel like a new retransplant into the U.S. I never really thought about these issues, these racial issues, until I came back. And even with the upsurge of racial
consciousness
in America, it's still like the Asian voice doesn't matter in America somehow, that it's not even in part of the dialogue yet. You know, there's the black and white, but somehow all the other races haven't quite you know, fit in yet. So I'm still struggling with that. I'm not quite sure how to talk about.
I think you that. Guys got to hire my people's lobbyists.
Are you
yes,
South
they are
Africans?
Very, very effective. Very effective.
No, the other tribe.
I'm not going to take that bait. I'm not going to go. I think I would just suggest that the very mentality of the engineer, of the scientist, who doesn't understand often legal or political or social currents that maybe, you know, underway. They tend to think of things just so, you know, clinically and analytically. They maybe don't understand. They think, I haven't done anything wrong, therefore I am not going to be in any trouble. I know from it's people close to me who have had, you know, things like this happen to them. Their first reaction is, you know, I have nothing to fear because I've done nothing wrong. And,
Right. But I think that because of how public some of these indictments are, and then especially this year with the federal elections, I think that we were, before the elections began or the campaigning began, some people in it that I was talking to were wondering, oh, is China even going to be an issue, or is ethnicity or Chinese even going to be brought up in the federal elections? I mean, the last federal elections, somebody had done a study and apparently China was mentioned in a negative light in something like 90,000 campaigns or campaign ads or something like that. So we were wondering if that number was going to go up or go down or, and I think that number will most likely have gone up.
Well, 80,000 mentions already by Donald Trump.
Right? By him alone. Right. And it's just interesting because these are not fact-based arguments, you know, about one or the other. These are, a lot of this is emotive, and that's what becomes, I think, very scary when you don't, and also why I very much believe in the leadership of the Chinese American community, both in America and in China, because there's a lot of anti-foreign sentiment in China that gets riled up as well. I mean, I remember listening to your This American Life and you telling your story about what happened after the bombing of the Belgrade embassy, and that turned into all of this emotive anti-American sentiment in China.
Yeah, we can't win, can we?
No, but I think that's why, you know, not to be racial or anything, but I do think that as speaking for myself and for the people I know, I think that Chinese Americans tend to be a unique group that just has a natural kinship to both sides, and therefore it's really important. I think it's really important for Chinese American and their leadership to be recognized in all of these exchanges that are extremely difficult and extremely conflict ridden, and that you know, we tend to, as Chinese, even though we're American, as Chinese Americans, we still tend to not speak up as much about what we've done and what we just do it. But I think that there's something to be said about recognizing the role of Chinese Americans to keep the relationship peaceful on both sides.
Absolutely.
Both sides.
Yeah. I think we all have a job to do. And I'm very, very glad that we've got folks like you who are willing to do it. I mean, articulate and passionate and very dedicated. Where can we go online or whatever to find more information either about the racial profiling of Chinese scientists or to find out maybe if I am a person working in a secure research lab in the United States and I'm of Chinese ethnic heritage and I want to read about what I can do to...
It's funny you asked that. So you're not the first person to have asked that. So one of the things my office is at the Committee of 100 is working on is compiling a resource page on the Committee of 100 website.
Okay.
So very soon when you go to committee100.org, there will be some resources for you to read through. We've actually developed an educational one pager and a flyer to give out. To educate people and to engage them as part of the solution, to make sure that they're educating others in their community. And you know, we don't have all the solutions because I think advancing technology happens to be a very, very, especially between two countries, happens to be a very technical and nuanced practice that has huge merit for the world. And I'm not one of those scientists that has been doing this work, but I think that the scientists themselves have a lot and a lot to bring to this dialogue as well. So hopefully, there will be more and more focus on creating solutions for this.
Can I ask one more question about this? Is are these cases, are they deterring Chinese, ethnically Chinese scientists and technologists from working in the United States already? Is this already having an effect? Because, I mean, I would imagine that is, for the United States, mm-hmm. that is the main downside, is if this gets to be a big enough of a problem,
they lose all that talent.
Hyper-talented.
Right. Well, yeah, if everybody starts thinking that they're spies if they go into this field, then I do think that in the future this will be a deterrent. Now, these cases that came up, the four cases, the Eli Lilly case was probably the first one that happened in 2014, and then Sherry Chen and Xi Xiaoxing, and there's an increasing number of these types of indictments. I think that the fact that they're so high profile, but also very recent, it's hard to say what the effect will be immediately. But I do think this problem isn't going away. It's not like China's going away as a technology competitor, and the United States is going to stop having Chinese Americans work on technology. So I think that the chilling effect of people going into technology, I think it's a potential, and I think it would be a great loss for the United States.
Because again,
right. if you think of a lot of technology that we use, you know, Yahoo, Yahoo not as much, YouTube.
I still YouTube. Use Yahoo.
And I mean, all of Silicon Valley, all of the money that's flowing in Silicon Valley, I mean, that comes from people that believe very much in technology advancement in the U.S., and a lot of them are also working with Chinese companies like Baidu and others. So I think that I'm hoping that we are able to change the narrative so that it's not, the narrative doesn't become, oh, everybody is a spy and is a potential spy, but the narrative it's at least recognized that Chinese Americans, by and large, are participating as innovators and adding to the innovation of America, and therefore that they are part of the pride of American innovation in the
mm-hmm,
world.
Mm-hmm. Motive force, driving force.
Yeah.
Well, great. We wish you the best of luck in this endeavor, and we got your back. Hey Jeremy, let's roll on with some recommendations, man. What do you
all
say?
Right, I actually have two. The one that I just thought of kind of halfway through this show after talking about your brother's Broadway show is it's On the Media, which is one of my all-time favorite radio shows and
right.
podcasts. Bob Garfield, one of the hosts of it, interviewed George Takei. And they spent quite a part of the conversation talking about
Allegiance.
Your brother's show, about Allegiance. So that's very interesting. The second recommendation is, I think, one of the best things I've read about China in years, and it is a Q&A. I mean, it's a simple Q&A that Ian Johnson, previous guest on the show and, you know, man about town, many talents in Beijing, he did.
He's kind of shitty at trivia, I have to say. No.
that's really an inside joke. I don't know about that.
We did this trivia contest where he was like in negative territory through most of the whole thing. It was funny. He was great. He was a good sport about it. I give him shit about it every time I see him, though.
So he did a Q&A with Baopu. The publisher, Hong Kong-based publisher, you know, whose daddy has been kind of locked up in his house since 1989 in right. Beijing. And he's just very funny and very caustic. And, you know, he doesn't give a shit. And it's, I think...
Remind really, you of anyone?
Really one of the best things I've read about China for a long time. So, Ian Johnson's Q&A with Baopu.
Interesting.
Yeah. Anything that Ian writes or has a hand in, I'm always up for reading.
Absolutely.
What about you, Kali? What do you got for us?
I also have two, and just thought of one. One is actually a book called Fateful Ties, and the author is Gordon H. Chang.
Right, the Stanford professor.
That's right.
Right.
Not the other guy. Gordon Chang.
Right.
But the one that writes about
US Chinese and
Chinese Americans in a very positive way. But he's written a book about America's history within the context of its ties to China, because mm-hmm. I think that very often America forgets that the world existed in the absence of America. I mean, what is history of America in the absence of America? And, you know, when it was founded, everybody was searching for China. And so I think it's a very interesting take on American history that we didn't learn growing up, at least.
Yeah, my sister and my younger brother both had him as a professor, I believe.
Really?
Yeah,
when they really? Were
both at Stanford.
He's a great guy. He's one of the Committee of 100 members as well. One of our newest members.
Great.
And the second recommendation I have is actually based off an event that I went to yesterday. There is a new group called Sup China. What's Up China? And I think it was also started by a Committee of 100 member named Anla Cheng, and it's a really great idea of curating all China related news into an app, and you can download the app on supchina.com. And it just launched, so I'm really excited to see what's to come of this new media.
Cool.
Platform.
Yeah, I was there. I was on that panel.
Yes, you were.
That was fun. Jeremy, you were there too as well. So,
I was indeed.
Oh yeah, we're rooting for Sup China. We're really hoping that they pull off something miraculous and wonderful.
I think they will.
Yeah, me too. My recommendation then. I'm just going to go. I mean, so I think there's been this kind of theme threading this thing, and it's all about allegiance, right?
Mm-hmm.
And maybe we'll title the episode "Allegiance." And so I'm going to just once more. The tragedy of this play. Of this musical is that it closes actually on February 14th. It may go on the road after that at some point in maybe a reduced form, but Broadway's a tough place. It had a good run. It ran from October 6th.
5 months.
Yeah, it's not. I mean, that's not a bad run for Broadway, but. Not everybody wanted to. I talked to my brother about it, and he said that in a lot of the polling, people were like, it was all about not wanting to feel so bad about being an American. There's a lot of sort of shame. But I really want to, for anyone who has a chance, come see this show before February 14th. I know we don't have much time, and I'm going to push Dave to get this show up very quickly so that maybe...
In the next 12 minutes.
No, Allegiance, I saw Allegiance, I think the first week of it coming out. It was amazing. I thought it was really amazing, and I was really touched by the story, and I was really impressed by the music and the score, which was written by your brother.
Right.
By Jay Kwa, which is an amazingly talented... Attorney,
yeah, he's an attorney. he's actually the Supreme Court
musical,
bar.
Yes, but I was really, really impressed, and I think everybody should watch it.
Yeah, and if you don't get to see it, you can download the entire cast, the whole all the what was it, the score or the music. The entire recording, that's what I'm
right,
trying
the
to
album
say.
Came right. out.
Yeah,
it,
it's
right?
come out, right, right.
Oh, that's cool.
And you can buy it, you can download it on iTunes.
The music
or
is great.
It's amazing, and I think you can pretty much
Lea
understand
Salonga.
The story. Yeah, Lea Salonga is just angelic.
Yes.
I mean, the entire cast, though,
yeah.
I mean, it's
Leung,
just Telly
Leung.
Yeah. And, the music is great. It somehow manages to weave in interesting things. Japanese themed music without seeming at all orientalist. It doesn't
right.
Indulge in any of that ching chong or whatever the
and it's a beautiful
right,
it's
right,
a
right.
beautiful set, I will have to
yeah
say.
Yeah, the set's gorgeous too, and the mechanics of it were really great. Anyway, I'm gonna go see it again before I leave New York. It was just the best.
I'm gonna
cannot
to
believe
it.
How proud I am of my little brother.
Aww.
For this thing.
Yeah, well, you have reason to be proud.
All right, hey, well, thanks, Holly. It was so great to have you on the show.
Thank you so much.
And we'll have you on again soon, I'm sure. Jeremy, man.
A pleasure,
as always.
It again in New York.
Let's also just have a rip-roaring good time while we're here before we leave. And folks, happy Chinese New Year once more, and we will see you next week on the Cynic Podcast.
Happy Chinese New Year.